You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me.
James Curtis returns to the show this week. His biographies are never casual glances at the lives of famous people. They are rather detailed portraits of the lives and times of great artists of the cinema and are always expertly written and researched. James Curtis' work include biographies of W.C. Fields, Preston Sturges, Spencer Tracy, William Cameron Menzies, a great book about Mort Saul that we talked about last time, and his new book, Buster Keaton, a Filmmaker. James Curtis, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Thanks, Gary. Nice to be here.
Before we talk about your new book, let's talk a little bit about Mort Saul, because he's passed away since we spoke and since you published your great book about him. I was sorry to see him go, but at least you were able to get your book published in his lifetime. And what was his reaction to your book?
He loved it. His eyesight had failed him by that point, and so he couldn't read it himself. But I know a friend of his read passages to him, and so he was able to decide I hadn't done a hit job on him. And he was a tough guy to earn the trust of. And so it was kind of an accomplishment that we got the thing finished, I think. Nonetheless, it was a good experience. I'm glad I did it. And
me too. I think it stands as a legacy to his greatness, and I'm so glad it's out there.
Yeah, I think that it's one of these things that people communicate about kind of word of mouth, and I think over time more and more people have had a chance to read the book. And appreciate just the position he held in stand-up comedy, as a true innovator. And I don't think it's overstating the matter to say that he changed the culture.
It's the only book you've ever written about a living person.
Yeah, that was interesting. and part of the reason for that is because Mort wasn't much of a letter writer or anything. He did have archives of sorts, but most of them were clippings. And from his clipping services over the years. And so most of the story was basically in his head. And so I did 40 hours of recordings, which I think really over time brought out the real nature of the work and how he approached it, et cetera. So that's a book that could not be written now. It would have to have been done during his lifetime with his cooperation, I think.
Let me just mention the title for my listeners: "Last Man Standing: Mort Saul and the Birth of Modern Comedy." It's really a wonderful book.
Thank you. Thank you.
So you have this new book about Keaton, which I think is your best book. I mean, I like all your works, but I think this one is really just a great achievement, and I love it.
Well, thank you very much.
And there's a lot of things I want to ask you about it. And I have read the book. So I'll just tell you that once I had Robert Klein, the comedian, on the show here, and he told me that Larry King famously never read a book or looked at a book until 10 seconds before he was going to interview his. And then he would ask incisive questions like, "Why the raised lettering, Robert?"
Yeah, that's true.
But I want to ask you, I want to start by asking you about this cover photo of Keaton. Because now when we think of Keaton, we think of, the pork pie hat and the great stone face, and here you've got a picture of a man that is a young, handsome, serious individual. He does not look like a movie comedian.
Well, that was deliberate on my part, as was the subtitle of the book, A Filmmaker's Life. I wanted to throw a lot of emphasis on what he did behind the camera, not just in front of the camera. And so I specifically did not want him in costume. I didn't want to see the pork pie hat. I did not want to see him pretending to be the character that he was on screen most of the time. This is a book about a serious artist, and I wanted to project that on the cover so that people didn't feel like they were cheated in some way if they wanted a rollicking story about the little man with the flat hat on screen, and they get all this behind the scenes stuff instead.
Where did you find this photograph and who took it?
Harrell, George Harrell. And my editor actually dug it out. And the moment I saw it, I said, yeah, that's exactly what we want. So
I said, just a beautiful photograph.
Yeah.
Well, there's so many things about your book that I want to ask you about, but because your book is a biography of Buster Keaton, it is at least partially a biography of Fatty Arbuckle as well. And Fatty Arbuckle, a controversial figure because of the scandal that ruined his career, which was in 1921, I believe. Mm-hmm. And especially today in the Me Too era, in which we are told always to believe the accusers. And I think that's a good place to start usually.
Sorry, I usually unplug that. I forgot.
So your, can you give us your take on, well, I mean, I did read Buster Keaton's take in his autobiography, which, mm-hmm. So I will have us talk about his autobiography later, but tell me, what is your take on the Roscoe Arbuckle?
Well, I think he was innocent. You may have noticed that I included a footnote from a medical doctor who had studied the case and, who's an acquaintance of mine. And she was convinced based upon her ER experience, which was quite extensive, that you can't rupture a person's bladder by rolling over on them. If you're heavy, bladders don't rupture that way. She there was a record as part of the trial and the police investigation that the hotel doctor at the St. Francis had catheterized the woman, Virginia Rappe, at one point during his examination and got a little bit of colored fluid out, and that was it. And she firmly believes what happened there was the catheter, which catheters in those days were made of metal or glass. They weren't plastic. And so that he tore the lining of the bladder during the catheterization process, and that occasioned the infection that followed, and peritonitis, and then her subsequent death. Arbuckle had nothing to do with it.
You also mentioned the woman who said, who had accompanied Virginia to the party, and who had said that Virginia told her that Fatty hurt me, or whatever it was, that she had a sketchy background, or...
Yeah, to say the least. And there's little doubt that she was trying to use the Arbuckle situation for personal gain as much as possible. And she and Rappe were not friends. They were, you know, acquainted, and that was about it. And yeah, she did have a sketchy past. And she was apparently known in the industry as someone to avoid at all costs. And so when she was up there, she ended up being part of that gathering and proceeded to, they wouldn't put her on the stand because she had no credibility. So she was just somebody who talked to the press a lot. And Maud was her name, Maud Delmont. And so she helped frame the story because she was out there first in the press. And so after that, it was a matter of denying what she had claimed, not necessarily establishing the story as would be done in most cases through investigation.
It's interesting that what happens to Arbuckle, that, he, you know, at the height of his powers, he is basically denied access to the artwork that he could create, is basically what happens to Keaton as well a little bit later on in Keaton's life. And your book it sort of shatters some myths about that have always been kind of part of the Buster Keaton lore. Mm-hmm. And one of those is Raymond Rauhauer. So I'll tell you the story as I knew it, and you can tell us why that's completely wrong.
Okay, go on.
So I had become familiar with Buster Keaton when I was a little kid because he was on TV a lot. I particularly remember my brother and I delighting in a piece of film in which he was fitting a fat woman with cowboy boots in his store somewhere. That was a bit, I guess, from one of his Buster Keaton shows. And we laughed so much. We loved Keaton. But we had never seen any of his And we saw when comedy was king in the golden age of comedy. So we kind of were familiar with him that way. Those were those compilation, Robert Youngson compilation yeah. films that were popular.
And I had the same experience with him. I saw him for the first time in those things as well. So.
Yeah. And then the Buster Keaton Festival came when I was a teenager, courtesy mm-hmm. of Raymond Rojar. And mm-hmm. it played at a theater that I loved in L.A. called the Vagabond Theater. And every 3 days they changed the bill of another feature and a couple more shorts. And so I was able to see them all on the big screen. And I treasure that and love those. And here's the story that I knew. Raymond Rauhauer was watching television and saw Keaton on the Steve Allen show. And he mentioned to Steve Allen that he had a bunch of his films in his garage. And so Raymond Rauhauer looked up Buster Keaton's name in the phone book and called Keaton. And Keaton said he could come over. And he went over there and Keaton showed him some of the films in the garage and was holding the film up with this nitrate film, with a cigarette dangling from his lips. And he was saying, "Oh, I think this is the Navigator." And Rauhauer rescued those reels of film and created the Buster Keaton Film Festival, returning Buster Keaton to his status as a great artist. And Keaton, still alive and well, was able to reap the rewards.
Total fiction. Rauhauer was incapable of saying anything that was truthful, as far as I could tell. And that's a perfect example of that. No, Keaton took Eleanor told the story, Keaton's widow, that she had never seen the General. And this is when Rauhauer was running a revival theater in Beverly Hills. And they were showing the General one night. So Keaton took her to the theater to see the General. And Raymond Rauhauer was up in the projection booth and was alerted to the fact that Johnny Gray was in the house. And so he came running down the stairs and said, "I need to talk to you afterwards." And so that's where it came from, basically. By that point, Rauhauer even lied about the year that he met Keaton. It was 58. He always said it was 54. So that started the association, if you will, but there was a lot of chicanery that went on during the course of Rauhauer's trying to amass an inventory of Keaton's films, have prints that he had made, copies he had made off of other prints. And there's a famous occurrence, which is true, that Buster Keaton's house that he built in the late 20s, actually in the mid 20s, 26, in Beverly Hills, was later owned and the grounds were subdivided by the actor James Mason. It was considered kind of a white elephant in those days. And Keaton went up there one time because the Museum of Modern Art had asked him for a film. Well, his films were stored not in the garage of his home, but they were abandoned property that were contained inside a vault that had been built by Buster into the side of a hill. Kind of inside a gardener's shed when the house was built. And so prints of all of his feature films were in various states of condition were in that vault. And the legal owner of those films was James Mason. And he got the idea to, when he found out about this, he proceeded to offer them to the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, which really was not a film archive in those days. They took them. And so the Keaton inventory was with the Academy. And Raymond Rauhauer started to formed a corporation of sorts with Buster Keaton and Eleanor as officers, and then proceeded to go to the Academy and asked to borrow these films because Buster wanted to see them again. And of course, what he was really doing is taking them over to a laboratory and having them duplicated. So that's how Rauhauer started to build his collection of Keaton films in 35 millimeter. It had nothing to do with anything that was in the garage. He had no prints in his garage. He had a 16 millimeter projector. Occasionally he might go to a camera store and rent a print of one of his films, but no, there were no 35 millimeter films in his garage.
But there was a Buster Keaton Film Festival, so I guess you can't completely condemn Rauhauer as a crook or anything.
No, but a lot of people had that had that impression of him, though. I talked to a friend of mine recently who encountered Rohrer back in the days when Rohrer was coming to MGM and going through legal files. And I said, what was your first impression of him? He said, crook. So that seemed to be, I know Kevin Brownlow told me, I asked him one time what he thought of Rohrer, and he said, I couldn't stand him. So he did not have a magnetic personality. Let's put it that way.
You're listening to From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro, and my guest this week is James Curtis. He is an American biographer of important figures from the early days of the cinema. His works include biographies of W.C. Fields, the director and screenwriter Preston Sturges, director James Whale, the production designer William Cameron Menzies, the brilliant man behind Gone with the Wind and many other films, actor Spencer Tracy, comedian Mort Saul, and his most recent work, Buster Keaton, A Filmmaker's Life.
The real treasure of Buster Keaton, A Filmmaker's Life, James Curtis, was you spending 150 or so pages describing life in vaudeville and the makeup of their vaudeville act. I mean, we can see the films, but we can't see the vaudeville act. How were you able to reconstruct it? What kind of research did you have to do?
Well, you go back to the publications of the period. You go back to memoirs. Buster describes some aspects of working in vaudeville at various times in his life. So really, it's kind of a smorgasbord of things that you pull out and make use of. One of the great resources for early stuff like that is a paper called the New York Clipper, which was a very early trade paper for entertainment. It was started not long after the end of the Civil War and existed, kind of limped into the 1920s. It was acquired by Variety at that point. But if you want to know anything about medicine shows, burlesque of the period, lawn bowling, you name it, they had stringers and correspondents everywhere. And the medicine shows especially would write letters into the editors in New York City and say, well, here we are. We're in such and such. We play three nights here and then we move on to the next town. And our company consists of, and they give you all the names. And it might have been one of those Indian medicine shows where you have Chief So-and-so and Squaw. They were there for authenticity purposes. And they would be selling them $3 for $5, in other words, and liniments and mystical cures and patent medicines of all sorts. And so so you get some of that. Joe Keaton and Harry Houdini were correspondents. So you go back and look at some of the Houdini correspondence and see what was going on during that period of time. The Clipper was especially helpful in that there's no formal record of Buster's birth. And so, which was in Pickway, Kansas in 1895. And so I actually was able to find a mention in the Clipper of Buster's birth. Due to correspondence between the company and the Clipper, and confirmed the date back in those contemporary times that he was indeed born on the 4th of October, 1895. So you find great things like that, but it's just a matter of poring over all that stuff. One of the great advantages that I had this time, as opposed to say when I did the Fields book 20 years ago, was that back in the days of Fields, I had to go through physical copies of the Clipper to follow his adventures in burlesque initially. And these papers were actual physical copies that were in the special collections room at University of Southern California, USC. And I could only get to them in the afternoons. And of course, there was no index to them. So the papers were in great shape. There's a lot of fiber content in the paper in those days. The bindings were falling apart, but the papers were in good shape. And so I would just go through them and just eyeball the pages and try to look for words that are key mentions of things that would pop out at me. And that's the way I found what I did. Nowadays, you've got ProQuest, and you can go in and search papers like that, search variant spellings, and you find all kinds of marvelous things. And you don't have to get in the car and drive to a library somewhere, or get on a plane to go to somewhere. So that was a big help. It saved me a lot of trouble, let me put it that way. And I found things I probably would not have found if I'd had to rely on my eyeballs alone.
Well, you mentioned Fields, and there's a certain overlap in your books. I mean, Spencer Tracy, who you spent many pages describing in Spencer Tracy, A Biography, makes a cameo appearance in your Buster Keaton book, which is, you know, it's kind of nice when your subjects turn up. Did Keaton and Fields ever play on the same bill in their vaudeville days?
Yeah, a couple of times, actually. The three Keatons, one time in Boston, as a matter of fact, with Fields on the program. And Fields was a tramp juggler still at that time. I don't think they were particularly close at that time. But later on, Buster expressed great admiration for Fields, saying he was one of his favorite comedians. And and Fields returned the compliment. He met my Buster greatly. So although he was 15 years older than Buster, but they had a mutual admiration, not only in terms of the respect that came from the success that they knew in vaudeville and later in motion pictures. Fields especially was one that it was in a lot of ways a comedian's comedian. And so people like Buster and Burt Lahr just thought Fields was the greatest, and he was.
And of course, Fields made some silent pictures, but really found himself when he was able to talk.
It's hard when you watch the silent films of Fields, you always miss the voice because he had there was so much a part of how he expressed himself verbally as well as physically. And it's partially for that reason that when Fields got into talking pictures, they remade most of his talking pictures were remakes of his silent features in most cases. So they went back and did them right the second time. His silent films are interesting, but I don't think they're superior to the talking versions.
Well, so we were talking about the Buster Keaton Film Festival and how that finally brought Keaton's greatest work out, and we were able to see it and enjoy it, and it's been around for ever since. But the last things that I was able to see were his early sound pictures. They didn't come around until maybe 10 or 15 years ago. And is another one of the myths, you know, is that, well, as soon as he started talking, that was the end. He never made a good picture again. And your book tells us that that's not exactly true. And looking at those pictures, you know, they started off kind of promising.
Well, I think I avoided looking at the talking pictures myself. I had not seen any of the MGM features, talking features, and I had not seen any of the educational, the two Reeler comedies as well either. So when I came to those, it was with a completely blank mind and with full familiarity of what happened before that. And I did that on purpose. I had the extreme luxury of being able to watch his films in the order in which they were made as I was writing the book. So when I'd come up to a point where he starts on, say, Three Ages or Our Hospitality, I would stop it and I would sit down and watch the film, usually with my wife. And I would have a pad of paper next to me on the table. And as the film progressed, if anything caught my attention or if I had any thoughts or an adjective of some sort might occur to me, I'd scribble down a note, you know, and then that would form the basis of my notes about the film. And I think initially, and as I learned, the first talking film that they did with him was Free and Easy, which is a terrible picture. Expensive. It's just one of your basic demonstrations of early talking technology and its drawbacks. And Buster had virtually nothing to do with the preparation of that film. He was just treated like an actor, an employee. And this is a man that just a few years earlier directed and co-wrote and starred in The Generals, which is even to this day considered one of the great silent comedies, if not the greatest. And so that was not a good experience for anyone in particular. It was minimally profitable because they spent so much money on it. And it was accorded decent reviews by the press in the time. There certainly were worse talking films out there. But it was certainly not anywhere close to a model of how Buster could navigate the talking screen in the future. He was so unhappy about it that Irving Thalberg, who was in charge of production at that point at MGM, gave him his head on the second one, which is called Doughboys, told the supervisor, who was also Thalberg's brother-in-law, to back off. And Doughboys is much more Keaton-esque. The problem with Doughboys is that Buster was drinking during that time because of problems at home and at the studio to some degree. And so there are scenes in Doughboys that he is obviously smashed and got a reputation around the studio for being unreliable. But then Buster bounced back, and the third film that he did for them, third feature, was called Parlor, Bedroom, and Bath. And that's a pretty good one. Doughboys is good, is not great, but it's good. Parlor, Bedroom is very good and seems to strike the proper balance between dialogue, which Buster wanted to diminish as much as possible, and physical action, a lot of which was unscripted, I learned. So Parlor, Bedroom, and Bath is pretty good. And it could have represented a nice progression from Free and Easy to Doughboys to Buster sobering up and behaving himself on the Parlor, Bedroom. But it came down to the supervisor on his films. It was a guy named Larry Weingarten, and who did not understand Buster's screen character. He may not have thought that Buster was funny at all. Louis B. Mayer certainly didn't. And so they fell back into this pattern of putting Buster in properties that did not suit him at all. And Passionate Plumber, for instance, which was based on an older film called Her Cardboard Lover, Sidewalks in New York, which he thought was the worst feature he ever made, one after another. By the time of Want No Beer, which was his last talkie, Buster was in a perpetual state of intoxication. And Mayer, in Thalberg's absence, Thalberg had a heart attack and was recovering from it. He very happily fired Buster. And that was the last that Buster saw of MGM for many years.
So just like we were saying about Arbuckle, this great filmmaker exiled from his craft, really.
Yeah. And, you know, if you took someone like Buster with his gifts at an earlier time and didn't give him the kind of forced education and comedy that came with being a child star in vaudeville, he might have made a civil engineer. He had that kind of fascination with the mechanics of filmmaking and what you could do with it. And so he could have gone off in other directions, but given the childhood that he had and what he knew about audiences and what he knew about physical comedy and the skill set that he had built up during 15 years on stage, there was nothing else really that he was suited to do. And when he got cut loose, he was in his early 30s. And here was a guy that spent most of his entire life making audiences laugh. And all of a sudden he was deprived of that capability, that opportunity. And so it took some adjustment, took some getting used to, and he had a tough, long road crawling back from that abyss, which included another bad marriage. And at one point in 1935, he was admitted to a mental hospital in a straitjacket.
Wow. Yeah.
Talk about hitting bottom.
I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. If you're just joining us, we're talking with James Curtis. He's a very fine biographer of American cinema personalities, including Preston Sturgis, the director and screenwriter, the director James Whale, who made Frankenstein, the production designer William Cameron Menzies, who was the production designer on Gone with the Wind. He wrote an in-depth book about the actor Spencer Tracy. He wrote about the comedian Mort Saul, and his new book is called Buster Keaton, A Filmmaker's Life.
I mean, a lot of silent stars certainly suffered for a variety of reasons, and many of them didn't survive. I mean, Arbuckle died young. John Gilbert, for instance, didn't live very long.
Well, you know, all these people have their vogues, and the ones that are able to survive the waxing and waning of public affection, they go through different stages in their careers. Fields's vogue did not last all that long, and it was helped greatly by kind of a happenstance career in radio. Harold Lloyd and Chaplin both had enough money that they could survive bad times. Chaplin, I was surprised recently to hear a friend is working on a book about a portion of Chaplin's life. I found out that Limelight, Chaplin's later film, was actually a big financial success. I always thought it was a flop. It was a flop in this country, I think. But
it didn't come out here until 1972 or something.
Well, no, Limelight was issued in the 50s, but it didn't get much play because Chaplin by that point was the boogeyman of the American Legion and you name it. And so there were protests, and that was the last film that he made that was released in real time in America, the foreign markets embraced it greatly, and it made a lot of money. Apparently, that surprised me. I didn't know that. King of New York was the one that didn't get shown in this country until much later. That was made in England in what, 58, 59, something. So the ones that could survive were the ones that had been good about saving their money. Buster never had much of a head for money. He was interested in the work. And as long as he had enough to pay for cigarettes and, occasional fling, he was happy. And so he really didn't have a safety net when Mayer pulled the rug out from under him, which is what happened, in effect. But as we see later on, he's a workaday comedian with extraordinary past and extraordinary skills. And when television came along, he was there and ready for it.
It's kind of interesting that the television work came at a time when his early work was obscure and you couldn't see it. And today, his early work is everywhere, and you can't find his television work. His television.
Well, you can look on YouTube and find some of it, but he was all over the place. He was on Ed Sullivan's show a lot. He was doing occasional things in feature films, flashy cameos like in Sunset Boulevard, for instance, but television was the closest, especially when he got into commercial work. Closest to what he had been doing earlier with short subjects and short comedies. And that was his approach to doing commercials, like for Alka-Seltzer. He did a whole suite of those in 58, I think, and where he's interacting with Speedy Alka-Seltzer. And that sort of thing was great as far as he was concerned, because he got paid when he made them. He got paid every time they got shown. And so he said those were Jim Dandies, in his words. There were all kinds of guest shots. And then into the 60s, we would see him on things like Route 66 and Twilight Zone and the Desi Lu series, Greatest Show on Earth, which had a very unusual dramatic cameo by Buster in their last show, as a matter of fact.
You find that one? Where did you find that one?
Paley Center has a bunch of them, and so does the UCLA Television Archive. So between those two, I was able to see most of the stuff that I wanted to see. There's one that has eluded me, and I'm fearful it doesn't exist anymore. But there's a TV version of the Ayn Rand play, which is the night of January 16th. I always get the date wrong. I think it's the 16th. And it's a courtroom drama, and it was made into a movie, as a matter of fact, at one point. And one of the gimmicks for the play is that nobody on the jury speaks during it. They're just present. And so for Lux Video Theater, where they did the adaptation, someone got the idea to make the jury in this television version have the jury comprised entirely of silent film figures. And Buster was on the jury. Viola Dana was on the jury, et cetera, et cetera. And the foreman of the jury was Max Sennett himself. And
oh, wow.
So I would like to see that very much, but I have been thwarted in all of my attempts to see if I could find a print existing somewhere. I'd get on a plane to watch that
one. Well, after you've spent, and I'm assuming this book took, years.
Five
years. So after you've spent years with a subject and William Cameron Menzies or Spencer Tracy or Preston Sturges, are you like done, or are you still like, oh, I hear something of Cameron Menzies that I haven't seen before that I must take a look at? Or are you still interested in all of your stuff?
Well, I'm still interested. I'm Saturday night, for instance, I'm seeing the new restoration of Invaders from Mars, part of the TCM festival here. So and I've seen it already. It looks beautiful, but this is going to be the first public showing of it Saturday night. Grama's Chinese. So I'm still interested in this stuff. I do sometimes, to my frustration, come across great things that I would put into the book after the book has been published. So that's a frustration sometimes that I find out more about something. But I want to know, and I do keep copies of everything marked up in red pen of things I will change when I get the chance, or I'll correct if there are typos or misspellings or whatever. You do your best with these, and always something creeps through, it seems. But so far there hasn't been anything too terribly earth shattering about what I found in the Keaton book so far. So but people will say, did you know that this was here or that was there? And so you think, oh, okay, but I got to document it. So
now with the restoration of Invaders from Mars, what is it that has been restored? It looks, the color is more true. I mean, the ending is still the same, right?
Yeah. Well, well, there are two different endings. There was a foreign ending and a domestic one. And, it's a dream in
our version. Yeah.
And then in the foreign versions, apparently it's not a dream.
Is a cop out, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's kind of a cliche, but so much of it is so good otherwise that I don't hold that against it really. Dead of Night is a dream also when you think about it. That's one of the most fabulous endings there ever was in a horror movie, I think. But the big thing with Invaders was it was Cinecolor. It was shot in a two color process, kind of cheap Technicolor wannabe, and so the colors could vary greatly, and over time the original elements got damaged or otherwise were not available, and so it took a wonderful team of people to put it back together again, successfully headed by Scott McQueen, who used to be head of preservation for Disney and also for the UCLA Film Archive to do it. And so Invaders probably looks better than it did when it was on screens in 1953. So I'm anxious to see it with a full audience and see how they react to it.
At Grauman's Chinese.
Yeah. Yeah. I haven't been in there so long. I guess they have some side theaters that they've built there as well. So I don't know where this is.
But I hope it's on the big screen. Yeah. Come on.
That would be nice. Yeah.
Well, this book, it's so great. Congratulations on it. Buster Keaton, A Filmmaker's Life, and the author, the brilliant James Curtis. Thank you for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
My pleasure, Gary. Thank you.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.